I've got to say, I've heard the trumpet used as a percussion instrument. Join us on The World.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. My thanks to my colleague Jennifer Ludden for sitting in for me last Friday. We're going to start the program today with international affairs. President Obama is in the Netherlands today for a previously planned nuclear security summit, but Russia's decision to annex Crimea, which had been part of Ukraine, has captured the attention of world leaders meeting there. Here is President Obama today after his meeting with the Dutch Prime Minister.
Europe and America are united in our support of the Ukrainian government and the Ukrainian people. We're united in imposing a cost on Russia for its actions so far.
But as you might imagine, this country is not united on the question of how the president has responded to the crisis. Critics say he hasn't gone far enough to stop Russian aggression. And what these critics see as his tepid response to past crises is part of the problem, they say. But others say President Obama is being unfairly criticized by political opponents who continue to disrespect him for their own reasons. We wanted to hear more about this debate. We also wanted to hear more about options in Ukraine and the way forward. So we're joined now by two of our regular contributors. Corey Elens is a former communications advisor to the Obama administration. He's now a senior vice president at Vox Global. He's here with us in our Washington, D.C. studios once again. Welcome back.
Good to be with you.
Mario Loyola is a former foreign affairs advisor at the Pentagon and in the Senate. He's also a columnist for the conservative National Review magazine, and he joins us from member station KQED in San Francisco. Mario Loyola, welcome back to you as well.
Great to be with you.
So let me start with you, Mario. You were telling us earlier that this situation in Ukraine has been a long time coming. So obviously, without giving us the short course in European history, just tell us why you say that.
Well, it was pretty clear in 1994 that the situation that the Cold War left behind, especially in Ukraine and Crimea, was one that the Russians were going to have real difficulty living with. And like many settlements of big conflicts going back to, you know, the Treaty of Westphalia of 1648, I mean, every big treaty has within it the seeds of a future conflict. Mm-hmm. And one of the tasks for foreign policy is to be able to look at those areas of potential conflict and make sure that the conflicts don't happen. But the difficulty is knowing when to be flexible and when to be firm. And I think that here, you know, you have a situation in Ukraine where within the borders of modern Ukraine were left large areas that had always been Russian, including the Crimea and parts of eastern and southeastern Ukraine. And so the Russians were left with a grievance, and, you know, we have to distinguish between whether that grievance is really legitimate and the methods that they're using to go about dealing with it now, which I think have completely, in essence, changed the subject.
I understand what you're
really
saying.
You're
saying that you cannot justify the forcible annexation of Crimea. I understand that that's kind of your baseline point of view. What's your assessment of how the president has responded to this?
Well, my question is, and again, it's very difficult to come up with the right strategy, but my question is whether it's really going to make sense to try to coordinate sanctions that go after really what are areas of common interest with the Russians, for example, the natural gas supply to Central Europe and Eastern Europe and things like that, without confronting the Russians directly in the Ukraine. I mean, I think that the Russians have created a situation now where it's not just the post-Cold War order with respect to Crimea and Ukraine that they're trying to revise. They're trying to challenge a basic tenet of the world left behind by World War II, which is that we don't change borders by force. And I think that so the central front in that challenge is Ukraine. And I think that we should be confronting the Russians directly in the Ukraine.
Do you think there has to be the threat of force for there to be a credible confrontation, Mario?
I think that you have to apply enough pressure that the Russians will seek negotiations.
Corey Elens, let's turn to you now. The president has been criticized in some quarters heavily, mainly by people on the right who say that his tepid response to past crises is part of the reasons that the Russians kind of went forward here. You're very critical of the critics, in part because of the timing. I mean, your argument is that people who criticize the president at a time like this should be ashamed, which is pretty strong language itself. Why do you say that?
Well, there used to be an edict that politics stopped at the water's edge, right? We understood that if the president of the United States was going to be engaged in geopolitical issues around the globe, that we needed to be have a united front. That's simply not the case here, because our conservative friends have gone over the bank in their criticism of him, and that's just out of bounds at this point. Basically, the president has three audiences that he's dealing with right now. First, he's dealing with a war-weary American public. These are folks who have endured more than a decade of war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and any time there's a sense of saber-rattling, they get unnerved. So he has to be sensitive to that. The second is obviously the international community. They're watching his response to the situation as well. And then thirdly, and most importantly, you have Russia and Vladimir Putin. Right now, the president is taking very measured, engaged steps, bringing together an international coalition to deal with this issue. And that is the same strategy that we used for more than 40 years during the Cold War that effectively we won out. So who would criticize, I think they need to take a step back and appreciate the broader context of history.
But what if they think he's wrong? I mean, if their argument is that the stakes are quite high here and they think he's wrong, you simply feel that as a matter of not just tradition, but of efficacy, they should be quiet or express these issues privately and not publicly at this juncture? What's your view?
I think that's exactly correct, especially when you appreciate who we're dealing with in Vladimir Putin. Just take a look at the aggressive nature that he's taken over the past year or so. First of all, he intervened in the issue in the situation in Syria last year. And he did that, I believe, because he wanted to make the United States look bad, quite frankly. Second, he takes in Eric Snowden and provides him with asylum. And then finally, he takes this very aggressive action against Ukraine. And he's almost daring the United States and the broader international community to push back against him. So we have to appreciate that this is a Soviet era former KGB official who is longing for the glory days. And we need to keep that in mind as we take a look at the broader context of what is really happening here and why we all need to be on the same side.
I think you meant Edward Snowden.
Edward Snowden, exactly.
If you're just joining us, we're focusing on foreign policy today and the U.S. role in Crimea in the current crisis involving Russia's annexation of Crimea. Our guests are Corey Elons of Vox Global. He's a former Obama administration communications advisor. That's who was speaking just now. Also with us, Mario Loyola. He's a former Pentagon advisor. He also writes for the National Review. So, Mario, what about that? I mean, the argument that I don't know, the chorusing that your argument is out of bounds, but do you feel that perhaps political opponents, like, for example, the president's former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, who wrote a piece about this, should temper their criticisms, at least publicly at this time? So I'd like you to ask that. And I also want to ask you more about your idea about what would pressure look like, credible pressure, in your view, look like?
Well, first of all, I'd like to know more about this idyllic period that Corey's talking about, because I can't think of any in American history. I mean, during the Reagan administration, the domestic politics of our foreign policy was totally paralyzed by a very strident Democrat opposition to almost every aspect of the Reagan administration's foreign policy. And the same has largely been true going back decades. I think, and from my point of view, I mean, I think that conservatives have a point in looking at the enticing weakness that the president has shown, for example, in Syria, in a lot of areas. He seems to pursue a policy of not confronting people on purpose, thinking that that's going to preserve the peace. And you know, as Secretary Donald Rumsfeld used to say, weakness is provocative. And so I think that we're seeing some of what we saw the Soviet Union do in the early days of the Kennedy administration, which is to say, you know what, I don't think that the Americans are going to stand up to us, so let's see how far we can go. Now, I don't think that my approach to the administration's policy and to what the Europeans are doing, I don't think is terribly political. And I think that if a Republican administration was in power, they would probably default to a lot of what the current president is doing. So I don't see this as a terribly political situation. I do, however, in response to your second question, think that the situation in Crimea is much more of an emergency than the president seems to be approaching it as. You know, you've got Russian troops massing on the eastern border of Ukraine. You have military installations of the Ukrainian military being overrun in Crimea. And they are likely to be, you know, the Ukrainian military is likely to be in a deplorable state of readiness and morale throughout the country. And I think that the possibility that the entire military establishment of Ukraine could just fall apart and plunge half the country into lawlessness, that would make a Russian invasion almost inevitable. So I think that we should be rushing to buttress Ukraine's security forces and even putting in, you know, air defense and a couple of Patriot missile batteries. I mean, no one's talking about large numbers of boots on the ground, but you've got to put significant defenses on the ground for the Ukrainians, you know, and if to the extent that they're not asking for them, it's because they're too. I have to suspect that it's because they're too scared to ask for them, and they don't want. And that may be our fault for not being clear enough that we are going to defend the sovereignty and the security of Ukraine.
Okay, I give you the first word, Mario Sof, to give Corey Elintz the last word on this round. Corey, final thought from you.
Well, again, I think we have to be measured in our approach here, and you don't want to put every sword you have on the table at the outset. As the president is engaged in conversations with world leaders in Europe during his trip this week, I think they may get to the point where they decide those types of actions need to be taken. But for now, the measured approach that we're using to place sanctions against individuals around Vladimir Putin who may have an influence on him standing down, that's the first step in making sure that we're moving in the right direction.
Corey Elintz is a former communications advisor to the Obama administration. He's now a senior vice president at Vox Global. Mario Loyola is a former advisor at the Pentagon and in the Senate on foreign affairs. He's a columnist for the National Review magazine. Obviously, we'll stay on this story. So thank you both so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
Just ahead, African-American fraternities have counted some of this country's most accomplished black men as members, including Martin Luther King Jr., Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, the poet Langston Hughes. But hazing continues to be a problem for some of these organizations. In the wake of new scrutiny of white fraternities, we'll ask how black fraternities are handling the issue. That's coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
On the next Fresh Air, Bob Mankoff, cartoonist and longtime cartoon editor at The New Yorker. He has a new memoir. We'll talk about his life, editing other people's cartoons, and creating his own.
I did a cartoon with a couple in bed, and the guy is saying to the woman, "What's your opinion on some sex marriage?"
Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support comes from the Auto Mall of Champaign on Moreland Drive, a new car alternative offering hundreds of late-model vehicles, including luxury sedans, family minivans, and SUVs. A listing of cars and trucks available is on the web at automallofcu.com. The Auto Mall invites you to join them in supporting WILL.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Writer Caitlin Flanagan sparked a fresh debate about college life with her story, The Dark Power of Fraternities, for The Atlantic magazine last month. Her year-long investigation focused on many problems, ranging from drunken brawls to sexual assaults to hazing deaths that are often associated with the nation's fraternities. But she focused her reporting, as she was made clear, mainly on predominantly white, nominally integrated fraternities. She did not focus on historically African-American Greek organizations, which play a significant role in college life on many HBCUs. Walter Kimbrough, president of Dillard University in Louisiana, did focus on this for the March issue of The Atlantic. He wrote that many of the students who turn to historically black fraternities for fellowship and support on campus often find humiliation, abuse, or worse. And he is with us now. President Kimbrough, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you.
Also joining us once again is Lawrence Ross. He's the author of The Divine Nine, The History of African-American Fraternities and Sororities. And we often talk to him about these issues. Mr. Ross, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Great to be here.
So, and we should mention that both of you are members of a black fraternity, Alpha Phi Alpha. So maybe, I don't know, President Kimbrough, why don't you start by asking, let me start by asking you, why were you attracted to that experience for yourself?
Well, part of it for me is that growing up in Atlanta and seeing a lot of the men who were very active in my church, my father's also a member of the fraternity, and I had a history of involvement in high school. That was one of the things that drew me to the organization. I was at the University of Georgia, very small black percentage, and so you're looking for those meaningful relationships, particularly for a young man. And so knowing of the work of the organization, people that were influencing me in church or at high school, that was important for me. Then when you look at all of the history of the organization, I mean, that was an easy sell for me to want to be involved.
Was it a good experience for you?
It was a great experience. I've had leadership roles through that organization. I always tell people that a lot of the skills that I use as a college president, I actually learned as an undergraduate, served on our board of directors as an undergraduate, had a chance to interact with college presidents. So it was excellent training for what I do on a day-to-day basis.
So the problems that are now being talked about with hazing, for example, is that something that is a problem on your campus?
Well, I always tell students on campuses like mine or wherever I'm on a campus is that it's a double-edged sword. There's a lot of positive things they can get from the connections I have and what I know about the institution, but they understand they're going to be held at a higher standard. So there probably is a level of fear that exists when I'm on a campus that doesn't exist other places just because, I mean, I've had experience with this, that not only are people going to sue them, they're going to sue me and the institution because they're like, well, this is a guy who studies this, so if they did something wrong, everybody, you know, is held to a higher standard. So I feel bad for the students in that regard, but it usually helps keep a lot of the, you know, food foolishness down.
Okay, I don't think I heard a yes or no. Is this a problem on your campus or not?
Oh, I don't know if it is a problem or not. I would say that no, I haven't had in terms of major hazing cases on our campus, in terms of chapters being suspended for hazing, at least since I've been here, and that's been a year and a half. We haven't had any cases, so that's a good thing. But is it possible that there is something that exists? I'd be naive to say no.
Lawrence Ross, you've written a history of black fraternities and sororities. In fact, you're kind of the go-to person on this question. Caitlin Flanagan, in her piece, made it clear that alcohol is a very big part of the problem for a number of these white fraternities, or at least they were formerly all white and, as she called them, sort of nominally integrated. That alcohol is a big problem. Off-campus housing is a big problem where they're kind of outside of the eye of university, you know, administrators. But you still say, and you have said, that hazing is still a problem on these black fraternities and sororities. What kind of behavior are we talking about? And when did this start to be a thing?
Well, I think we diverge from our white counterparts in that African-American fraternities and sororities tend not to have hazing centering around alcohol or substance abuse. Ours tends to be around physical activities. There's a tendency to be to set up challenges that have obstacles that deal with pain, for lack of a better term. And it's one of those things that has actually, you can go back to, you mentioned in the setup that Langston Hughes is a member of Omega Psi Phi, and he talks about the fact that when he was pledging Omega Psi Phi in his autobiography, and I think in the 1920s, he talked about the fact that he, you know, received, you know, strokes from wooden paddles due to the fact that he was a writer. And it was his brothers just did it arbitrarily because he was a writer. So it goes back that far. But you start to see, like in the modern era, you start to see and Brother Kimbrough can actually talk a lot about this too. You see the evolution of hazing from the 1950s and 1960s, and you see the intensity. And then you see the reaction from the organizations to try to put some type of structure around our traditional pledge systems. But each time they do it, they pretty much simply concentrate the actual abuse that actually occurs during their pledge programs.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. Can I stop you there and ask you that? Is it your view, and I understand that I'm asking you to take an educated guess, if I may, that this behavior has escalated over time? Is it your view that this thing has escalated? And if so, why might that be?
I think it's better word instead of escalated would be metastasized. It's like a cancer. It was terrible, for lack of a better term, prior to Joel Harris's death at Morehouse University for Alpha Phi Alpha, in terms, which was like the catalyst for changing the whole kind of school days above ground pledging. What it basically did was, for the last 24 years or so, is to put it underground and to then create a scenario where the abuse has incredibly intensified because we can't see it. And I'm not saying that the solution would be to bring it above ground. I'm just saying that pretty much that the organizations have seemingly lost control over the majority of their chapters in terms of being able to know whether or not their organizations are actually legitimately following the programs or if they're not. And it's like how Brother Kimbrough is talking about, at Dillard, even as the president of Dillard, he can't reliably say that someone is not right now, as we're doing this interview, hitting someone in the head. We can't do that. There's almost like an assumption on all of our campuses that it is a possibility at all times.
I want to go back to President Kimbrough's piece where he wrote about this, where he said that, for example, that these kids all know that hazing is illegal. You said they all must know hazing is illegal. They must know it is against their respective fraternity and campus policies. They must know that if caught, there could be harsh sanctions, including legal ones. And yet year after year, they beat people. You also say in your piece, President Kimbrough, that they're national leaders, scholars, lawyers, and experts, all who say don't haze, have no credibility with these young people. You say they're young geniuses because you say that they come in here, maybe they're 17, 18, 19 years old, and then like a year later, they're all geniuses kind of running the place. Why is that? Why doesn't your word have more say? Why doesn't the word of these distinguished people, presumably part of the reason these young people want to join these groups, because you went there and you were part of them, that they're not listening to these messages? Why do you think that is?
Well, because at that time and in that place, it is their organization. It is their chapter. I always tell people that there really is a myth that these are national or international organizations. Not for the average student. Their world of that organization is the people on that campus and those who have recently left, whether they graduated or not. That is the organization. It's not these other folks. And so those are the people that matter the most, what they think and what those that have recently left think, and not the experts, not the national presidents. They don't care about any of that because this is what they want to do. And so they sort of, I guess, rationalize, or as I say, irrationalize, that what they want to do is the right way. And they've signed documents saying we will not haze. They go to workshops on campus. So they understand all of that. But then deep down, they were saying to themselves that this is what we want to do. I experienced it, and if this person is going to be a legitimate member, they must experience this too.
Can I add to that?
Yes, I was going to ask you about that, because one of the things I think many people might find surprising about this is that, it's so much a part of the work of African-American leaders has been to expose the physical abuse of young people of color by people like law enforcement and things of that sort. So I think a lot of people don't understand why is it that then you come to a place that's supposed to be a safe haven and you find your brothers or sisters engaging in physical abuse as a rite of passage. And I think that if you could just spend one more minute, Mr. Ross, on this, what do you think is the appeal of this?
I think one of the issues is that even within the construct of who we are, we do great work, and we also live within this issue of hazing kind of in a conspiracy of delusion. I think our organizations aren't really in the anti-hazing business. They're more into the anti-mitigating liability business. I don't have any doubt that our leaders don't want to see anyone hurt, and they don't want our fraternity and sorority brands to be set up as a place where people actually get hurt. But I don't necessarily think that they think that pledging is wrong. I think the members like the idea of non-hazing, as long as it kind of conforms to their own rationalized version of what is and what isn't hazing, which usually correlates to their own personal experience. And then we get the aspirants who want the respect and the traditions and everything else that drew Brother Kimbrough and myself to our fraternity. And they're looking to do whatever it takes to be validated. And then at the end, if we get an end product, what happened, someone gets hurt, then it all falls apart. And I think it's a, I think it really stunts us in terms of, you know, one, our moral, our moral ability to talk on issues when we are sometimes seen as the problem.
President Kimberly, we have about a couple of minutes left, and you wrote in your piece about some of the steps that you are already taking to address this. You say that, look, when I travel to speak to students, I don't appeal to their sense of right and wrong anymore. I just give facts, let them know the consequences, and that if they mess up after I have been there, I will anxiously testify against them. And you show gruesome injuries, you show members in handcuffs, you talk about financial settlements that affect their parents, and you said that they're shaken for a while, but you're not sure that this has any lasting impact. What might?
You know, that is the million-dollar question, and maybe Brother Ross and I, we have conversations offline. At, maybe it's, at some point we'll figure it out. I don't know. I'm really at a point where I'm throwing my hands up, and I don't know what it's going to take to change the culture when, you know, logically you can point out to students that here are the rules, here are the consequences, and you don't want to get involved in this, but they still feel like the risk is greater, or is the reward is greater than the risk. So they continue to do these things, and then when something happens, it's like, oh, well, now I need sympathy and those kinds of things. I have no idea. And, I mean, I've been traveling and speaking on campuses since right after I finished my undergrad degree, so that's over 20 years. And I don't see the change in the culture. I don't.
Lawrence Ross, what about you? What do you think would make a difference? I mean, Caitlin Flanagan, in her previous piece on about fraternities in general, focusing predominantly on previously all-white or predominantly white fraternities, made a big push on alcohol and getting alcohol out of that experience. And she said that, in fact, getting alcohol out of the experience has actually improved recruitment because a lot of people were disgusted by, and good candidates were disgusted by the environment in these places, and so they were avoiding them, and actually their recruitment has surged. But you're saying alcohol is not really the issue here, that that alcohol is not a big factor here. So from your perspective, Mr. Ross, what would make a difference?
I think you have to change the whole paradigm. I'm with Brother Kimbrough. Sometimes I throw my hands up too. And I actually go to a white fraternity that actually has done kind of like changing the paradigm. Sigma Phi Epsilon has their Balanced Man program, which is kind of the idea that, you know, you get rid of pledging, which I don't think we could actually do amongst the black fraternity sororities. But the idea is continued development and basically providing value for the college member as they are there. So almost what the idea is that if we provide you with enough resources, with enough value, to the point where you look and you say, wait a second, I'm getting all this mentorship, I'm getting all this value, why would I throw it away by doing X, Y, Z? It's the only thing that actually could, you know, give some sort of balance to what is pretty much a very attractive thing to do, which is to feel tied into the traditions of pledging and hazing and the respect that you actually get. You have to have something beyond just, you know, what we do, you know, which is to tell them not to do this, because it doesn't really have that much of an effect. I've been on campuses where I've told them, you know, all the same things Brother Kimbrough has told them, and then read 2 months later that they were involved in hazing incidents.
How do you just briefly, Mr. Ross, how do you feel now that this is all coming out? As a person who's been following this somewhat in closed circles for a while, how do you feel now that this is all coming into the light?
It's good that it's coming out. I want some revolutionary action, not just from advocates, from, you know, like Brother Kimbrough and myself and a number of other people. I want some revolutionary action from presidents of some of the organizations, people who can actually change the paradigm and have the power to do it.
Lawrence Ross is the author of The Divine Nine, The History of African-American Fraternities and Sororities. He joined us from NPR West. Walter Kimbrough is the president of Dillard University in New Orleans. He was kind enough to join us from member station WWNO. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
All right, thank you.
Now we'd like to update you on a story that aired on this program last Friday. We heard from the Miami Herald about its investigative series called Innocence Lost. Reporters there documented nearly 500 children who had some contact with Florida's Department of Children and Families and later died of abuse or neglect. My colleague Jennifer Ludden spoke with writer Audra Birch about how so many children fell through the cracks at the agency.
These are cases where the families had been reported, sometimes multiple times, right?
Correct. You know, it runs the gamut. You have cases where, you know, the initial prior is not nearly as serious as what ends up happening to the child. But then you have cases that are on the other end of the spectrum in which there were multiple reports that indicated that, you know, in assessing it, you would think that the child was at risk.
We reached out to Florida's Department of Children and Families for a response to our conversation, and Interim Secretary Esther Jacobo spoke with us earlier today. Here's part of her response.
It is true that we have missed red flags in the past. So, you know, I would agree that we have not in the past done a great job at determining risk of future maltreatment. Even before the cluster of deaths that first brought media attention, we had begun implementing what's called the safety methodology. And then the risk assessment tool that is evidence-based on the high-risk families, we know that we need to have some intervention, or the probability is that they will come back with a future maltreatment, whether that's death or something else. And so that's one huge thing that we're in the middle of implementing right now across the state.
That was Esther Jacobo. She is Interim Secretary of Florida's Department of Children and Families, and she joined us from her office in Miami. To hear the full conversation about the Miami Herald's Innocence Lost report, please visit our program page at npr.org/tellmemore. Coming up, if you were a police informant who'd gotten in over your head, not just giving information, but making it up, allegedly at the behest of the police, what would you do? Benny Martinez turned to two reporters at the Philadelphia Daily News.
He was afraid that either the police officer wanted him dead or the drug dealers on the streets wanted him dead.
Barbara Laker and Wendy Ruderman's investigation exposed widespread police corruption and earned them a Pulitzer Prize. Now they tell the story behind the story in Busted, a tale of corruption and betrayal in the city of brotherly love. That's next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Sit for Life and Herman Miller, featuring the Aeron chair, including the true black color. Sit for Less is now sitforlife.com. From the Gilchrist Foundation, in support of NPR's commitment to coverage of the arts. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. And from the estate of Joan Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio. This is NPR.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Next time on Here and Now, a Fulbright fellow in India woke up on a train platform and didn't know who he was.
I believed that I was a pharmaceutical tourist, and I was just doing heroin throughout India with this woman named Christina, whose face I can picture right now, but who never existed.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
Are you a fan of the show Says You? Would you enjoy an hour of bluff and bluster, words and whimsy, live and in person? If so, you're in luck, as host Richard Scherr is bringing Says You to the U of I campus on Friday, May 2nd at 7:30 p.m. And we're excited to announce that WILL Radio will be hosting a special reception beforehand where you'll have a chance to meet with Scherr and his panelists. For more information on how you can attend and get premium seats for the show, go to will.illinois.edu.
Today's programming is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by Country Financial Representative Scott Jackson, Village at the Crossing in Champaign, committed to helping clients achieve peace of mind in retirement through effective planning. Online at scottjacksonfinancial.com.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. If you are a fan of the police procedural, in other words, cop shows, then you are probably familiar with the occasional storyline of the cop who crosses the line. So he might get a little too physical with suspects or a little too close to informants. In the fictional version, it's all in the name of justice and all's well in the end. But what if crossing the line means making up false information, robbing innocent store owners, sexually assaulting women, and it's not all right in the end? That's the story that two reporters at the Philadelphia Daily News uncovered in their 10-month series for the paper back in 2010, acting on a tip from a frightened police informant. The reporting eventually led to a Pulitzer Prize, an FBI probe, and now a new book that tells the story behind the story. It's called Busted, A Tale of Corruption and Betrayal in the City of Brotherly Love. Wendy Ruderman and Barbara Laker are the authors. I caught up with them recently when they were in town for a book signing. And before we begin, I should mention that this conversation contains details and language that some listeners might find disturbing. That said, I started by asking Wendy Ruderman to tell us about Benny Martinez, the police informant who got the story started.
Benny Martinez had been a drug informant for 7 years, which is an incredibly long time. And what was happening was he was working with this one officer, Jeff Chudik, and Jeff Chudik had some real estate. So Jeff was renting him a house. In Philadelphia, being a drug informant is actually a job. You get paid for every door knock you do in which drugs are exchanged. You get $100 if a gun is found. So the money that he was making was flowing back to the police officer in the way of rent.
Why did Benny come to you?
Benny was looking for some protection. He was fearful of his life. He was afraid that either the police officer wanted him dead or the drug dealers on the streets wanted him dead, because what had happened was he and Jeff Chudik set up a big-time drug dealer who had enough resources to hire a very high-powered attorney, who that attorney then hired a private investigator and suspected that Benny had set him up. So basically had Benny followed around by the private investigator, who took pictures of Benny coming out of Jeff's house and establishing that they had this relationship that crossed the line.
Well, first of all, what did you think was wrong? And then secondly, what turned out to be even more wrong than that?
Right. Well, they had a financial arrangement. So that went against police department protocols. You can't have a financial relationship with your police informant. And so they also had a built-in financial incentive, the rent, to make drug buys. But the problem was that they were running out of people to set up. So basically, Benny, who had a drug habit, was going to places and not doing the buys because he didn't want people to know that he was the informant. So they were sort of making things up.
But it went far beyond that. So Barbara, yes. Maybe you want to pick it up there. When
sure.
did you realize it was actually bigger than that? So.
It went way beyond that when, after we started running the first stories about the relationship between Benny and Jeff Chudik, Wendy got a call from an attorney who represented a merchant in Philadelphia, a Jordanian man. And he said, you know the squad you're writing about? Well, they came into my store and they raided the store for these little Ziploc baggies that some of the corner stores sell. And in turn, they came in and they busted the video surveillance cameras, ripped wires out, and looted the store. And we remembered that from going through all these search warrants that we had for the first part of our story, we remembered that a lot of these merchants all across the city, all four corners of the city, had been raided by this same squad, where other squads did not raid these corner stores, mom and pop stores. So we went back to this room that has all the search warrants, and we went through hundreds and upon hundreds of warrants and picked out the ones where this squad raided bodegas, is what we call them in Philadelphia, these corner stores. And we tracked down these merchants across the city. And independently, across the board, they all told us the same story.
Which was what? Because some people might say, okay, well, so maybe it's against the law to be selling these little Ziploc baggies, because those can be considered drug paraphernalia.
Yes.
So, Barbara, what's so terrible?
What was so terrible is these cops came in. A lot of these merchants didn't even know they were cops. They were in plain clothes with just police on the back. And they dismantled the video surveillance cameras or cut out the wires, so there would be no record of what they did in the store. And what these merchants told us they did did is after these people were arrested, they looted the store. A lot of these merchants were hardworking immigrants who dealt mostly in cash. They paid for all the merchandise in cash, the rent, everything they had was in cash in the store. And they all told us that the cops not only took cash, but it took batteries, cell phones, anything they could get their hands on, lottery money, and then left the stores in shambles and arrested these immigrants who had these stores.
And lied about how much money, because they actually had to invoice. They had to invoice things that they took in for evidence, but what the store owners also told you is that they lied. They said they took 1,000 when in fact they took 7.
Right. The police have to fill out a property receipt. When they raid a house or a store, they have to itemize what they took. And they're able to legally confiscate things if they do arrest someone for drugs or whatever. None of these stores that we used had drugs in the store. They just had these little baggies.
And did these people have arrest records? Were these people who were known bad citizens, as it were?
None of them did. Not one single person who we used, and they all went on the record with us, and none of them had criminal records.
Yeah, and I think what
That's Wendy.
This is Wendy, yeah. What was so extraordinary about it is this had been happening to them for quite a while, and I think each store owner felt alone in this. Like, they sort of they didn't tell anybody about it. I mean, they came from countries in which the police are corrupt, which, you know, people disappear, those kind of countries. And so they felt like this was maybe part of the street tax, like we're just going to just be quiet about this. And they didn't realize that it was happening all over the city. I mean, we had people from, like Barbara said, the Jordanian man and then Korean, Dominican, Chinese, Vietnamese, all different people told us the exact same story.
And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Wendy Ruderman and Barbara Laker. They won the Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting in 2010 with the Philadelphia Daily News in a series of articles that exposed police corruption in the city. They're telling their story in a more complete way in a new book titled Busted, A Tale of Corruption and Betrayal in the City of Brotherly Love. Now, I want to mention that what was going on in Philadelphia at the time when the series began, about half a dozen police officers had been killed that year in the line of duty, that people were not impressed with this reporting, if that's fair to say. You got a lot of criticism for it, Wendy, if you want to tell that part.
Yeah, we began this series at a time when an inordinate number of police officers were being killed, and it was horrible, and the mood in Philadelphia was very pro-police, understandably so. They have a very dangerous job. So our first series was basically cops skirting the law to set up drug dealers. So Barbara and I even wrote a story that let out a big-time drug dealer. He was looking at federal charges, and he was a drug dealer. But because they cut corners and lied on the search warrant, the feds had to let him go.
Well, it wasn't just that people just criticized you. Let's just be a little bit more clear about it, shall we? I mean, that a police blog listed your home addresses. People expressed the hope that you would be raped.
Right.
And that you would call 911 and that no one would come and things of that sort. Did that ever, I mean...
Yeah, I mean, there's a website. It's now defunct, but there was a website in Philadelphia, and police officers would post things about what they wanted to happen to us, which is they hoped we got beaten, raped. They nicknamed us the Slime Sisters, which, you know, we to this day like kind of joke with each other about. But it was serious at the time. The Fraternal Order of Police, which is a very powerful union in the city of Philadelphia, held a big press conference right after we ran the first stories to debunk our stories and say, really, we were like the lowest of low. You know, one step beneath a drug informant is a Daily News reporter, is the way they termed it.
Did that affect your reporting?
No, because at this point, we were working on the stories about the merchants and the bodegas, and we believed in this story. And when you believe there's something that horribly wrong and such a wrongdoing done by people who are supposed to protect and serve us, we weren't going to let go. So we weren't going to walk away from this. And in fact, it made us want to fight harder to find the truth.
Tell me about the sexual assault aspect of the story.
Right. Well, we had been hearing all along that there was one officer who his nickname was the Boob Man. And even police officers outside of Philadelphia who were in narcotics and worked closely with the Philadelphia police knew he had a fetish for large-breasted women. And during raids, he would take them into separate rooms, like back rooms, and he would pull up their shirts and fondle them. And in one really terrible case, he shoved his fist up a woman's vagina, and she was just so traumatized by it that she went to the hospital that very night. And they did a rape kit, and Internal Affairs had known who this cop was, and they took him off the street. But the thing is, then she disappeared because she began to get threats from the cops. And so,
how do you know she got threats from the police? How do you know that's who was threatening her?
Well, right. That's a good question. Go ahead, Barbara.
There was a she lived in a neighborhood in Philadelphia. And at one point, there was a police car that drove up and saw her walking along the street. They had her get in the car and they threatened that she better drop it or she'd be sorry.
So let's fast forward here. What has happened as a result of this? You've demonstrated that people are creating false information in order to arrest people who may or may not be guilty, but that's what trials are for.
Correct. Yeah.
You find out that people are raiding these store owners under, let's just call it a pretext, and stealing their merchandise. And then at least one person, sworn uniformed police officer, is using the pretext of these raids to fondle and sexually assault women. What's happened?
Well, that's the outrageous part of it, that these officers, they're still on desk duty. They've been riding a desk. They don't have police powers. They're not able to have a badge or a gun. But they're still collecting their paychecks. They're still building up their pensions. The FBI won't say whether they're finished their investigation or what is the status of their investigation. None of the women have appeared before a grand jury or even been brought in to be questioned, nor have the bodega owners, the shop owners. And we, Barbara and I, really feel that if these women were not minorities, if these shop owners were not minorities, if this was happening in a more middle-class suburban area, there would be consequences.
Now, the city has paid out in damages, has it not? I mean,
yes.
There have been lawsuits. And who has that money gone to? It's something like $2 million to settle lawsuits. Who has received that money?
It's gone to some of the merchants and two of the three women who sued the city. And the city has settled without saying they're guilty of anything, but they have settled. But I think that one of the most other outrageous parts of the story is that one of the merchants who actually had a backup video in his store that he provided us, he has lost his store. He's had to sell his house. And so he has lost his faith in America and the American dream.
Well, why? Why has he lost his store? Because
he was charged with this misdemeanor for having the little baggies, and then he owed money to lawyers because of the criminal case that he was charged with. And so he's lost a lot of money, so he could no longer afford to keep the store. And the women, too, they feel like nobody has heard them.
Does it make you crazy a little bit that more has not occurred to bring accountability to people who behaved in this way, you know, wearing the badge, representing your city?
Definitely. It really does. Because the women who talk to us, and same with the merchants, I mean, they really put themselves out there. And we see what they did as courageous. And for them to not even be questioned by a grand jury or be interviewed, I think is, I mean, it eats at us every day that that hasn't happened.
It's a hard question to answer, but why do you think that hasn't happened? Does either of you have a theory about that? Wendy, you started to offer some thoughts about that.
You know, it's very frustrating. We've heard that the FBI doesn't do sex crime, so they're waiting for the district attorney's office to do something about this officer and the women, and that the DA's office says, well, we're waiting for the FBI to finish its investigation. But I also think that Philadelphia is one of its problems is it's a big union town. The union has all the unions really have a stranglehold on the city, and it just seems like in Philadelphia, the Fraternal Order of Police, they're like kingmakers. They can make a mayor. They can break a judge. They basically control a lot of the political powers that be, and people are terrified of the Fraternal Order of Police.
What do you want people to draw from this?
Even when we were writing the part of the story where they were cutting corners to lock up drug dealers, we still believed that that was wrong and that that should have a light shined on it because it's a slippery slope. If it's maybe the drug dealer one day, maybe it's someone like me or you the next day. So we don't feel like police officers should be able to break the law, to enforce the law. Yes, we got backlash, but letting people know that this was going on was important to us.
Wendy Ruderman and Barbara Laker are investigative reporters with the Philadelphia Daily News. Their work earned them the Pulitzer Prize in 2010. They recall that entire experience in a new book titled Busted, A Tale of Corruption and Betrayal in the City of Brotherly Love. And they were kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Wendy Ruderman, Barbara Laker, thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
We should mention that we did reach out to the Philadelphia Police Department. A spokesman there says the department has not had a chance to read the book, but they say they take all allegations of misconduct or corruption seriously. Switching gears now, it is almost April, and that means it is time for Tell Me More's annual tribute to National Poetry Month. This is the fourth year of our Muses and Metaphors series. Throughout the month, we will combine two of our passions, poetry and social media. We ask that you hop on Twitter and tweet us your original poems, poems using no more than 140 characters, of course. If you are not quite sure how all this works, take a listen to some of our favorite submissions from last year.
First housefly, first bee, staggers in flight and falls on the windowsill. April redux, come spring, coming in.
When I was young, tacos were seen as poor food. People al pastor forced to hide between the flower of civilized American culture.
Childhood, westerns, and zizzing the fog. Ring the ties, sting the bearings. Mother had no words for it. My tongue, no home.
Monday, Monday, even my reality checks are bouncing.
We even heard from renowned poet Nikki Giovanni.
Morgantown, West Virginia. Haiku for Ethel and Lucy. Pinto beans, fried cornbread. Clean spring water. Rocking chair, your smile, home, peace.
This year we are adding a twist to Muses and Metaphors. We will tell you all about it next week, so tune in. But in the meantime, start sending us your original Twitter poems using the hashtag TMM Poetry. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.